Hello? Yes. So welcome to this Christmas special Sutta class. As I've been saying, I hope it's not repeating the same joke to the same people again, but as you know, it's a double demerit point time of the year for those of you who wish to drink and drive. But for those of you who wish to come to Sutta class, it's a double merit point weekend. So sadhu to your wisdom. Okay, so I picked this sutta this weekend. I just want to give some sort of a background, because I just want to talk a little bit about how important the suttas are to me personally. You see, I was actually asked to do a wedding, to come and do a wedding blessing, and I was listening to the bride to be, and she was explaining her situation and her partner, describing her partner. And you see, I don't get paid to show up. I'm not a marriage celebrant. So I had to try to explain to this person that, listen, look, I need my feed. I need my payment. So, you know, what's the meaning in this relationship for you? And, you know, we don't do till death do you part. And, you know, this kind of that what God puts together that no man can take apart kind of deal in Buddhism. We just try to find some sort of meaning to join people together. You know, what is the meaning in your relationship with this other person? And I said, this is what I can really try to bring to this ceremony. You know, I'm not the singing priest or some entertainment, part of the entertainment section of the wedding. I'm hopefully bringing some spirituality and meaning to this ceremony, and we will hopefully create a kind of a psychological milestone in your life. So after listening to this person, you see, there seemed to me a sort of a confliction arose in my own heart. And I needed, you know, I was looking to resolve this confliction. You see, the bride is a nurse, and she works in ICU, and she works in the children's ICU. She is very dedicated, talented, wonderful Australian lady. And she wishes to marry a very dedicated Australian man who has, you know, he's done a four-year degree in university, and he then was recruited by the army and given a scholarship to study medicine, which he has completed. He's completed his medical studies. And he wishes to be a trauma surgeon, right? A trauma surgeon, a war surgeon. And the confliction really is that I think this lady found this very difficult, because it's a big ask for her. She has to join the army community. She has to live in barracks and, you know, be deployed and moved around and have husband deployed to theaters of unknown destination and unknown duration. It's a big ask. And she's sort of talking to me a lot about sacrifice. This is a young Australian woman telling me about sacrifice. And that it was something that she really had found difficult to accept, that her husband or to be wished to join the army and participate, you know, even as a medical doctor. So it's quite a morally complex environment, a little bit, you see. And our values and our morals and our culture get brought to question. What's important to us, what's not important. So I wanted to, this sutta came to mind. So I thought, okay, maybe I'll look to this for my own refuge, for my own, you know, a little bit of guidance. What does the Buddha have to say around these issues of military affairs and so on? This one came to mind. And actually, just last week, I met the husband-to-be. He came out to the monastery, really nice, just such a nice couple, and we had a wonderful conversation, and I'm looking forward to their ceremony. But I still felt this tug in my heart. So, you see, the suttas are very, very useful to me in giving me a reading around certain areas and certain things in my life. So this is the background. And I would also like to add another note on this sutta. This sutta is also repeated in the Parinibbana Sutta. So Ajahn Brahmali has been giving a long series of lectures on the Parinibbana Sutta. So he has, in his very first talk on the Parinibbana Sutta, actually covered this sutta as it exists in the Parinibbana Sutta. And he discusses it in a very wonderful way. He discusses it from this kind of point of view of comparative study, and also, you know, how realistic and how detailed the information in the sutta is, and how historically accurate it is. And, you know, these are extraordinary documents or records of the Buddha, the Buddha's teaching, the time of the Buddha, the kings, the kingships, the political systems. And if you ever read like things like Bhikkhu Bodhi's In the Word of the Buddha, you know, where he divides it up into 10 chapters or 10 sections, where, you know, the Buddha was not a one-trick pony. He wasn't always just telling you about Anapanasati and how to, you know, the Four Noble Truths, the Eightfold Noble Path, dependent origination. He also discusses martial affairs, you know, how countries will be conquered or not conquered. So this is also a wonderful thing, and I would suggest, if you wish to, you know, have a more of the usual, shall we say, discussion on this sutta, that you go back and replay. You know, you can get it on YouTube. In fact, I just listened to it myself this morning. The first in the Parinibbana Sutta discourses, because it actually covers the same sutta. But this is quite a wonderful thing also, that the same sutta, you know, can be split out, and here we find it again in the Anguttara Nikaya, and it's in a collection of, you know, so the previous sutta is the teaching that the Buddha gave to the Wajjians, or as they're called here sometimes, the Laichavis as well. And just briefly as a background, the Wajjian country was a kind of a democracy or a republic. A kind of a one. Not everybody had a vote, but it was like a Greek kind of democratic system, meaning like important people in society would gather in a kind of a parliament, and they would discuss things, and they would form an assembly like we think of as a kind of a parliament, and they would discuss things and make decisions in that way. So the Buddha had previously advised them on how to form a stable republic. Okay, so the previous sutta is that the seven important things. And so later on, another kingdom. This time it's actually under an autocrat who is King Ajatasattu. And King Ajatasattu, as we will go into it, he wants to take over this Wajjian country, you see. He wants to invade it. But before he does, he decides to send one of his ambassadors to discuss, just mention it to the Buddha, and have a good listen to what he has to say. And very interestingly, obviously, that the Buddha repeats the same teaching. So it's quite interesting that the Buddha, you could say, gives the goods away. You know, what are the key principles? What are the key pillars? So somebody who is very Machiavellian could, you know, actually use that kind of knowledge to pull down the pillars of society. But it actually seems like in the sutta, it certainly gives King Ajatasattu or his ambassador reason to be cautious, because it's not easy to pull down very strong pillars. So this is a very interesting sutta, I think, in some ways. And I've been trying to use it to, couch my own mind and, appreciate the role sometimes that even a military plays in a republic. Like, we live in a democracy here in Australia, and we need to understand the role that our own army has to play in supporting our welfare and happiness. So, thus have I heard, on one occasion, the Blessed One was dwelling at Rajagaha on Mount Vulture Peak. Now, on that occasion, King Ajatasattu of Magadha wished to wage war against the Vajis. He said thus, "As powerful and mighty as the Vajis are, I will annihilate them, destroy them, and bring calamity and disaster upon them." Then King Ajatasattu addressed the chief minister of Magadha, the Brahmin Vasakara. "Come, Brahmin, go to the Blessed One, and in my name, pay homage to him with your head at his feet, inquire whether he is fit and healthy, agile and strong, and feeling at ease. Say, Bhante, King Ajatasattu of Magadha pays homage to the Blessed One, and with his head at your feet, he inquires whether you are fit, healthy, agile, and strong, and feeling at ease. Then say thus, Bhante, King Ajatasattu wishes to wage war against the Vajjas, and he says thus, as powerful and mighty as these Vajjas are, I will annihilate them, destroy them, bring calamity and disaster upon them. Learn well how the Blessed One answers you and report it to me, for Tathagatas do not speak falsely." Okay. So, again, just a background. We're all, I think, quite familiar with Ajatasattu. He was the son of King Bimbisara, and Ajatasattu was a very ambitious young man, and he ended up, killing his father to take the kingship. So he was quite a brutal tyrant, we can say, from this kind of activity. I mean, certainly he was prepared to perform an ultimate act of cruelty. And his father, it is said, was a sotapanna. He had achieved the first stage of enlightenment on hearing the Buddha's teachings, and descriptions are that he was a kind, loving, caring father. And this son that he had so lovingly raised had turned around and killed him. And again, Ajatasattu went on himself to reap in his own life, his own death, at his own son's hand. Again, so quite brutal, this kind of, killing. And this is actually something that goes on to this present day. If you're aware of how some of these dictators and their rule happens, they can be incredibly brutal. So, for instance, a few years ago, Kim Jong-un, this Kim, who's the head of North Korea, when he became the leader of North Korea, he quite famously assassinated his brother in KL Airport. He assassinated his uncle. So he removed all of his near and dear ones, so that his own lineage would be the exclusive line within the family. So there's a long history. If you read the Glass Palace Chronicles, which are the recorded history, there's a version in Sri Lanka and also a version in Burma of where the monks record the kind of history, obviously from the monk's perspective. And I've read the Burmese one, and I mean, it's a gripper. If you want to read a thriller, it is not a history like any other histories. It has rises and falls and tragedies and brutality beyond belief, and very, very sick ways at times of where kings will kill off all of their family members when they take the throne and so forth. So anyway, I wanted to discuss a little bit of what I call moral theory or moral foundation theory. Because sometimes we need to, I want to, as I go through the next set of the seven principles that the Buddha discusses, I wanted to just give a small lens of how moral culture can vary between different groups of people. So morality is this extraordinary capacity of the heart, and it's on morality that in some degree that civilization itself is being built. So in Buddhism we have a tremendous emphasis given to sila, to morality, so it's really primal. But we have many different like moral bubbles that we can coexist within the world or with even within a nation itself. And each moral bubble, you can say, can become kind of complete and unified and very an emotionally compelling worldview in itself, easily justifiable by observable evidence and nearly impregnable to attack from argument by outsiders. So, you know, if you grow up in communist Russia, shall we say, you know, you can be very persuaded by the communist Russian perspective of the world if you grow up in a capitalist, shall we say, America. I'm only using these words. Please don't think I'm trying to be partisan. I'm just, you know, sometimes it's helpful to have a little label on things at times. But if you grow up in this uber-capitalist world, you will have that perspective. If you, you know, grow up in Australia, like I try to hear, you know, if I'm trying to describe, like, well, how is Australia different to America? Well, it's quite different. It's quite different and it's similar, you know. I've spent a long time living in various different Asian countries. You know, I lived in Burma. I lived there during the junta. I have visited since the junta, shall we say, disappeared into the shadows. I've lived under different kinds of rule and authority. So really there's a tremendous like bubble within wherever you live and how the values and the culture of an area, of a place, of a people, of the history, of the time matter. So we can't study our own mind, we can't study our own actions and ignore culture. Do you understand? We can't do this. They coexist. How I think is going to be very influenced by the culture of the environment that I'm in. And similarly, my own, because my mind is being conditioned by the people around me, and it's also being conditioned by the culture in which the people around me sit, right? And also, you can't study culture without ignoring some psychology, so the underlying drives, the human values and systems that are happening, and how different societies take these social practices and institutions and will develop them into initiation rites, such as even religions, which are being, you know, shaped by concepts and desires rooted deep within the human mind. So, for instance, when I joined the Sangha, we have an initiation rite. We call it ordination, right? Very ancient tradition. And we have very sort of strict rules about where I can be ordained and what I need before I ordain. You know, I need to have a robe and a bowl and various items, needle and thread and a belt and various goods I need to have as possessions before I ordain. And then we have this thing, what we call a sima, you can say like a religious ground, an area that's sort of sacred from our point of view, or is a distinctive territory, and so forth. So we have this kind of ritual to becoming a monk. And so these are very important to form a psychological marker in my mind that I've become a monk, and I accept the rules of monastic life. And this changes my behavior or helps me to facilitate the change in my behavior. You know? So if we look at morality in more detail, then there's an ethic of morality. You can call it the ethic of autonomy. So the idea is that people are first and foremost autonomous individuals with wants, needs, and preferences. People should be free to satisfy their wants, needs, and preferences as they see fit, so that societies develop more moral concepts such as rights, liberties, and justice, which allow people to coexist peacefully without interfering too much in each other's projects. So this is the dominant ethic in individual societies. So this is, in many ways, this will, I think, will resonate with a lot of us in this room, because this is probably a very strong ethic that many of us will have, that we be given, that we have rights, that we have liberty, we expect justice when we go to court or in any dealings, and that we should coexist peacefully without interfering too much in each other's projects. Right? You would agree with those things? So these are different aspects of autonomy. But this is one ethic. I'd like to propose another ethic for you. And this is the ethic of community. That people are first and foremost members of large entities, such as families, teams, armies, companies, tribes, and nations. These larger ethics are more than the sum of the people who compose them. They are real, they matter, and they must be protected. People have an obligation to play their assigned roles in these entities. Many societies therefore develop moral concepts such as duty, hierarchy, respect, reputation, and patriotism. In such societies, the Western world's insistence that people should design their own lives and pursue their own goals seem selfish and dangerous, a sure way to weaken the social fabric and destroy the institutions and collective entities upon which everyone depends. So for those of you who may have been born and raised in more traditional societies or in traditional cultures, I think that will also resonate with you. Family is very important. Clan is very important. Your language group is very important. Your caste is very important. You know, the family traditions, the culture, the where you're from, where you were born, what school you went to, what university you went to, your old school tie, they all matter. They're very important. So this is also an ethic. So I'd like to suggest a third ethic to consider when we deal with moral questions of morality, and that's the ethic of divinity, which is based on the idea that people are first and foremost as such temporary vessels within which a divine soul has been implanted. That people are not just there as an extra serving for consciousness. Many societies develop moral concepts such as sanctity and sin, purity and pollution, elevation and degradation. In such societies, the personal liberty of secular Western nations looks like libertinism, hedonic, and a celebration of people's more base instincts. So, for instance, here today we are gathered for a sutta class, a kind of scriptural class. You know, there are some that might say, well, you know, you're wasting your time, religion is rubbish, you're not maximizing your entertainment value, you could be out having a good time surfing or whatever it is. You should be maximizing your pleasure. So if one is strong in this ethic of divinity, then you can the emotion of disgust is a very moral emotion, which is clearly emanating, which clearly originates as the emotion to keep us away from dirty and contaminated things, and can be triggered by some moral violations. For example, if our partner betrays us, we feel, you know, intensely angered, or if you have a good friend and, you know, you find out that they're having an affair and you know their partner really well, you know, you can really feel like I've been slimed, or I'm like in a very uncomfortable position around this kind of behavior, you understand? So that we can feel disgusted, we can feel repelled. So the human mind automatically also perceives that there's a kind of a vertical dimension in social space running from, like, in Buddhism we have the Brahmas, the Devas, humans, the Titans, the ghosts, the animals, the different hell realms. So we have this idea of a social hierarchy within our mind, and this is related to this ethic of divinity. So, God is good, shall we say, and the devil is bad. And we have a whole range of things in between. And so we will view certain things to be elevating us as human beings and degrading us as human beings, right? So if a behavior is degrading to us, we will view that as disgusting, you know? And if a behavior is elevating to us, we might view that as inspiring, awesome, or elevating, lifting, uplifting, joyous, and all of these kind of effects, right? Emotional states. So moral disgust is a very important taste in the mind, and it is felt whenever we see or hear about human behavior, which shows them to be low on this vertical dimension. And people feel degraded when they think about such things, just as we feel elevated when we hear about virtuous actions. Okay? So the ethic of divinity helps us to order the universe, and things as well as people should be treated with reverence or disgust that they deserve. And it's a very important aspect of development. You know, in young children, they have a lot of strong magic, mystical thinking. So, you know, all the kids are looking forward to Santa Claus and presents coming. And if you've been a good kid, you know, you'll get a what you want as a gift. And if you've been a naughty kid, you won't. And all of this. So this magical thinking is a very important developmental stage for children. And it can be very harmful to damage that kind of development for them. You know, I mean, like, I've met people who were very, very spiritually wounded, you know, where they were not allowed to believe in things, or they were forced to believe in things. And it really can really be create tremendous harm for them, you know, where there's an abnormal sort of a corrupted sense of ethical divinity. You know, like some cults can really mess with people's minds with regards to these ethics of divinity and give them very strange ideas about what is wrong, what is right. You know, so again, I always try to teach morality in terms of what is wholesome and unwholesome, what is skillful and what's unskillful. I try and avoid in my own speech as much as I can. It's not easy because we're very conditioned, but to saying good or bad, because it's more of a judgment. But it's this ethic of divinity is a very, very important thing. So again, the ethic of divinity, the negative side of it is that it sometimes becomes incompatible with compassion, egalitarianism, and basic human rights. The ethic of divinity lets us voice the kind of almost unnameable feelings of elevation, awe, inspiration, and also the degradation of our sense of higher and lower self. So, for instance, we can become very vocal about what we might view as crass materialism, the hedonic nature of the world. We can become very judgmental because of this ethic of divinity as such within us. And we can become very, very sensitive to the in-group and the out-group. You know, that these people are pure and halal, and those people are not pure and not kosher, you know? So this is this ethic of divinity being expressed. But this ethic of divinity exists in all different tribes. You know, so for instance, some people could have a very strong ethic about, like, I only eat certain natural organic food and so on, and can be very ardent about that. You know, that we can get very strong on our ideology. Again, it's kind of a reflection of this ethic of divinity and something where it needs to be well managed. So, you know, the stories around this ethic of divinity, the ones that can trigger people very strong emotionally without being able to find a victim, involves either disrespect, which violated the ethics of community. For example, if somebody burnt the Australian flag on Anzac Day in protest, it would really upset a large number of communities. And you know, the military are fighting for the flag, they're fighting for the symbols and protecting it, and then somebody goes and burns it. It's very upsetting. I received an email from a friend of mine recently, just last week, another monk, and he said, I'm so happy to hear you're still wearing the flag of the Arahants. Do you know what the flag of the Arahant is? No? No? Anybody like to guess what the flag of the Arahant is? The flag of the Arahant. My robe. Yes, yes. So, you know, when I wear this robe, I wear it with respect. For what? It's just a piece of cotton. It's just a piece of material. No, it has a divinity to it. Okay? And I pay a price when I wear this robe. You know, I pay a price. You know? So I wanted to just give you a little background in ethics. Sorry, that's a big class in ethics squeezed into one small little synopsis. But as we go through these 7 points, I'd like us to chew on them a little bit with this little background of ethics in mind. Because if you really think about it, and if you just think that this year is the 100th anniversary of the end of World War I, and there was a great cost in that. There was a whole generation of Australian women and children that grew up without a father because they died. They passed on. You know, there was a great grief. So war is a tremendous price to pay for anything. So to have this kind of ego of Ajatasattu, somebody who had proven himself to be cruel, killed his father, take the power. And when he says, I will annihilate them, destroy them, bring calamity and disaster upon them, he means it. He means this. So this dictator is about to invade a republic. All right. So it's very interesting that the Buddha is going to now talk about the pillars of a society that can resist such a rather cruel gentleman. Not so gentleman, really, right? So I'm going to just skip down. Now, on that occasion, the Venerable Ananda was standing behind the Blessed One, fanning him. The Blessed One addressed the Venerable Ananda. So the Venerable Ananda, he's speaking to the Venerable Ananda, but it is answering the question posed by the Chief Minister, Vasakara, who is, you know, conveying the message on behalf of King Ajatasattu. So, Ananda, have you heard whether the Vajis are assembling often and hold frequent assemblies? I have heard, Bhante, that they do so. Ananda, as long as the Vajis assemble often and hold frequent assemblies, only growth is to be expected for them, not decline. So it's a very interesting point, or important, something very important in this that the Buddha is trying to come across. So here he's pointing maybe to an ethic of community, an ethic of that they have each other's back, that different families, clans and groups within the republic assemble, they gather together. And here in Australian life, we value very much our ability to assemble. We can go to concerts, we can go to sports events, you know, we can have peaceful protests, we have assemblies of government, state government, shire, the council, city councils, the local councils. We have assemblies of volunteer groups Volunteerism is huge, huge. This country would collapse without our volunteers. We're out with the Fieries, all voluntary assembly. People who get together, neighbors who get together, communities that get together and have each other's back for weal and woe, for the good times, but especially in the bad times. What J.K. Rowling's called foul weather friends. You know? I mean, the ethic of autonomy is very strong in Australia. We really believe that, you know, you have your own bit of space, you have your own block, you have your own house, you have your own car. Especially here in Perth and WA, it's quite a strong ethic of this area. But on the other hand, it's also a very strong ethic of community and assembly, where we can freely assemble. We do it often, and we do these things often. Only growth is to be expected, not decline. So it's a very important quality of a society, is this ability to assemble. And it's also quite interesting that, and you know, dictators and all these kind of people, they very much mess with assembly. They control assembly. They don't allow it. They don't like it. They're threatened by it. I'm not a political analyst. I'm trying to read the sutta and savor, maybe look into what is it saying to me a little bit. But I ask you also to just reflect in your own hearts. What does this mean to you? Have you heard, Ananda, whether the Wajis are assembling in harmony, adjourning their meetings in harmony, and conducting the affairs of the Wajis in harmony? Harmony, or the word unity, is the Pali word here. It has a few different meanings. I have heard, Bhante, that they do so. Ananda, as long as the Wajis assemble in harmony, adjourn in harmony, and conduct the affairs of the Wajis in harmony, only growth is to be expected for them, not decline. So it is, again, a wonderful thing that we maybe take for granted here, that we have free elections, we assemble, we don't feel threatened when we go down to the election booth, and we have these peaceful transitions in our government, you know? We can go down to a football game, we can be on the winning side, and we can walk out and not be expected to be beaten up by the losing side, you know? And we don't really need a lot of police around to make sure that that doesn't happen, right? You know, sometimes, you know, there was a time when I was growing up where soccer games were really, frankly, polluted in Europe with a lot of, you know, sectarianism and violence and ultras and all these type of things. And you didn't bring children to football games and, you know, so on. I spent a year just recently in Melbourne before I came here, and like Melbourne is sports mad, but it's so touching to see these big sporting events where it's like big, little and small going down to watch a sporting event. And we can all, we don't think anything of 100,000 people getting together in the, you know, cricket ground for the cup final or anything like that. And we don't, it's like nothing. Like, I remember there was up to very recently, it wasn't safe to play a big international cricket game in either Pakistan or in Bangladesh. In Bangladesh, because people get so excited that they riot. And in Pakistan, because there was just so many, you know, it was a political target and so on. So this is an important thing. This is an important thing that we enjoy here. This is something important that we take for granted, maybe. And the Buddha is calling to mind something about this. And we have these things. We had the clay pit issue at Bodhinyana about 20 years ago now, you know, where we went down and occupied the local shire office and so on, and peacefully protested and demanded that the clay trucks be sent on a different route and so forth. And we can do this. It's okay. Right? So have you heard, Ananda, this is the third one, whether the Vajis do not decree anything that has not been decreed and do not abolish anything that has already been decreed, but undertake and follow the ancient Vajji principles as they have been decreed. I have heard, Bhante, that they do so. Ananda, as long as the Vajjis do not decree anything that has been decreed or abolish anything that has already been decreed, but undertake and follow the ancient Vajji principles that have been decreed, only growth is to be expected for them, not decline. Now, when I read this anyway, at least what comes to my mind is this idea that we have in law and in justice of precedent. You know, and precedent is extremely important to us. And it's very, very interesting that there's a, I don't know how you would describe it, he's a primatologist. A primatologist studies monkeys, primates, right? I hope I've pronounced it fully, primatologist. Franz de Waal. And he has looked a lot at the great apes. He's looked at a lot of the great apes, and he does a lot of these wonderful experiments. I remember we showed it for the New Year's Eve party once, about 6 or 7 years ago. I pulled out the clip for it, so we showed it, about where he's feeding, you know where they feed the monkeys? And they're feeding grapes to the monkeys? So one monkey gets a sweet grape, and the other monkey gets a cucumber. So you have two monkeys side by side in a plastic. You know, they can see each other and they can smell. There's holes in the plastic and they can... So if you feed them cucumber, they're happy as Larry. They don't care. They'll munch away on cucumbers. They like cucumbers. But if you feed one of them cucumber and the other one grape, immediately there's a sense of injustice. And they don't like this. So the one who got the cucumber will feel like insulted or hurt. Why didn't I get my grape? And in this test, the monkey had to do a task. You know, he had to offer a token, like a little stone, to the researcher, and the researcher would give a reward. So there's a lot of funny little video clips around this test where the monkeys show like how really they got really infuriated by this unfair behavior, and this is this ethic of, you could say, autonomy. You know, a fair. I have rights. I deserve to be treated equally and fairly, and all of this has really been unfair. And maybe, you know, a certain amount of divinity. This is not, you know, am I less than this other person? Or a certain amount of community. Hey, that's not fair. And like Franz de Waal even mentioned that he even found examples of where the monkey being rewarded with the grape refused to take it even. And they also found this in dogs, because they knew this was going to be trouble. It was, you know, that injustice wasn't worth the reward. Okay? So it's a very powerful argument that morality is quite strongly encoded into us. And we have a moral and a judicial logic thinking going on within us. You know, we have a sense of what's fair and reasonable, and we like precedent. You know, and again, here in Australia, we can go into court and, you know, your lawyer is going to be looking for precedent, you know, that your case is like a previous case, that the court has ruled in this way or that way, and that's how they're going to try to work it. So precedence is incredibly important within the legal structure. And again, it's quite noticeable that, you know, any dictator worth his salt will come in and try to mess with this, mess with the courts, mess with the judiciary, try to change fundamental laws and so forth, and throw out precedents, and, you know, be a wrecking ball in this arena of what has already been decreed and undertaken and according to ancient principles. And it's very fundamental to us as a being, okay, that we get a fair go, right? It's very fundamental to Australian society. And this moral of fair go, for instance, is a very strong ethic here. So, you know, we constantly face in this society people who look different to us. But most Australians will say, but that person deserves a fair go. That's, you know, they're not getting a fair go. That's not okay. There's a very strong ethic in Australia around fair go. I would describe this as quite a cultural trait, a national trait. Have you heard, Ananda, whether the Vajjians honor, respect, esteem, and venerate the Vajji elders and think they should be heeded? I have heard, Bhante, that they do so. Ananda, as long as the Vajjis honor, respect, esteem, and venerate the Vajji elders and think they should be heeded, only growth is to be expected for them, not decline. So again, this is a very profound aspect, certainly, of my experience in Asian culture and within the Sangha itself. You know, we have elders. So Ajahn Brahm is an elder. And, you know, at times I have to put aside what I might personally think. And I defer to the elders on things. I defer to a sense of honor, respect, and esteem. You know, I put my head down. You know, and sometimes we try to show the new as, you know, anagarikas and novices and that, like, you know, some of Ajahn Brahm's catchphrases are quite useful. If in doubt, bow. You know, like sometimes you're wondering whether I should bow or not for some reason. Well, that's the little voice that'll go off my head. Just, if in doubt, bow. Okay, I'm in doubt, bow. You know, it's a respect to the teaching and the teacher, you see. And it can be very sweet, has been my experience. You know, it can be very, very sweet. And Ajahn often describes himself as the lead bus in the convoy. He cops a lot of flies out front. You know, it can be quite nice to be, for the last 5 years I was on Tudong, you know, moving around. And often I'm by myself or I don't have a sangha around me. And I'll tell you, it's strenuous being out front, copping flies, as Ajahn calls it. Okay, it's cruisy actually sitting back in the convoy. You know, I got asked to come down for this weekend, but most of the time I'm just like, just chilling. You know, Ajahn is sort of doing the tough work out front. I can just relax. And there's a team quality to it. And, you know, sometimes I try to remember that expression, you know, you're born a liberal and you die, it's a bit awkward here in Australia where liberals are conservatives, but you're born liberal, but you die conservative. So can I say with small L? All right? You know, when we're young, we think there's a lot of possibilities in the world. As we accumulate experience, we realize that there's constraints within the world, and I have benefited so much from elders in my life, you know, that as I get older, and people are asking me, what do I do and how do we do this and something like that. Even when I'm teaching now, so much that's just coming out of my mouth, and it's such a relief to me, is just elders speaking. It's just elders speaking. It's not this monk in front of you speaking. It's just the elder speaking. And I'm listening to what's coming out. And I'm going, you know, because I remembered when I was first encountered, you know, I was really practicing intensively in Malaysia in the early, you know, 2000. I came here in January of 2000. It was the first Dhamma talk I had here. You know, and I had, you know, spiritually gone up and down a few different alleys long before coming here, and I had been, practicing Theravada meditator long even before I came here into the 90s. And I still find a lot of what I'm teaching goes back to some of the earlier teachers that I had in the 90s, like how I teach guided meditation goes back to a layman. His name was, he slipped my mind now. Godwin in Sri Lanka, you know, how I teach and goes back to, you know, some of that programming. And I remember when I first encountered, I used to write down a lot of notes. You know, you get that kind of college school training here, and then people are saying, no, don't take notes, just sit and listen. And then years later, I'm teaching something, and you know, I'm reasonably mindful. So what's coming out is a response usually to the situation, and then I'm looking at what's coming out. I'm going, gee, I can't remember. I can't believe I remember that. You know, that's so and so speaking here. You know, these elders are speaking through me, and just as what they have to say goes back to their elders and their elders and their elders. And you know, the beauty here with the suttas is that we can actually quite go back to the Buddha himself. So this idea of honoring, respecting, esteeming, and venerating the elders, you know, and listening to what they should be heeded, and the growth is to be expected and not decline. No, and again, another like story of how another perspective, shall we say, like this is okay, this is 2,500-year-old stuff here that we're reading from. But I was also being struck, say, by the Aboriginal memory or record that they've passed down over time, you know, where for a long time they've been talking about, you know, the great history of the Aboriginal community. And, you know, as we do more and more detailed work, archaeological work and genetic work and various things, we're really establishing how incredibly old the Aboriginal community is. Like, I think I'm seeing numbers like between 60 and 80,000 years at the moment. It's an incredibly long society. And, you know, they're describing events like meteoroids hitting the Earth. You know, so there's like a large crater north of here. And you can find it. And they talk about it in their lore of this kind of great... You know, it's obviously described in metaphors and meteorites because they don't have a scientific description of it in the modern sense. But, you know, these records, these stories that are being passed down through the elders can be remarkable. Remarkable. And so too, again, if you... dial back to that first Parinibbana Sutta class by Ajahn Bramali in March of 2017. You know, he's talking about the veracity, the detail, the extraordinary, detail that are in here and can be found. You know, we can find supporting, or we can find consilience supporting these stories. We know that Ajatasattu is not a mythological creature. He really existed. To the best of our knowledge, he really existed. You know? This city or these areas existed, you know? And the description of the places and the locale and the clothing and the mode of transport and so forth existed at that time in that place. And it's an extraordinary document. So this is, again, this idea of honoring and respecting and esteeming and venerating the elders is very important. And it reflects the ethic of community quite strongly. Because within the ethic of community, this idea of valuing our tradition, our heritage, is very strong. And within the Sangha, you will find, like, the majority of monks are very conservative. And, you know, like I've spent a lot of time in Burma, I've personally known three, what they call Tripitaka Dharas, people who've memorized the whole Tripitaka. There's only 13 of them in recent history, right? And I've personally known three of them, and, you know, it takes such an act of faith to put aside so many years of your life to memorize all of these suttas and vinaya and everything else, right? And they have tremendous tests to make sure that the fidelity of every word, like it's not a normal exam. So it's not like, have you heard, Ananda, whether the Vajjayans do not, that's the next one. Have you heard whether they do not accept, abduct women? Continue. So they would have to immediately say, and girls from the families, and force them to live with them. you know, that's only one test. But they could also just say, when you get to abduct women, go back 10 lines and start from there. It's an extraordinary exam. Or mention every time that abduct women is mentioned in the suttas. It's, you know, it's like a Google search. They have to go, and they have a short time. They don't have a long time to come up with this. So it takes a tremendously kind of conservative nature to do this, where you value every word in this canon. And what I really like is the crazy stuff that's in here. So you have very conservative-minded people who do not want to change a word or have anything slip. And they will tell you about all sorts of weird and crazy things in here too. Stuff that morally they would like to remove. Free thinker stuff. Get it out. They don't want. You know, they will respect it no matter what. Very interesting how that works. So when you see stuff that is like the antithesis of what a deeply conservative person would hold, and, you know, quite frankly, the Buddha comes across as a real liberal in many ways. He is a very radical person compared to the people who will carry down his teachings through time. But they, in principle, will, with great fidelity, honor and respect the teacher and the teachings and the elders, even if they don't like it, even if they don't like what he has to say. And I have experience where, even though they don't like my behavior or something like that, they will say, it is acceptable. You know, it's acceptable even if it annoys me, because it's written. It's said. This is our tradition and fine. You know, it's going to be very fair. It's very interesting. It's a very interesting thing, because I'm not like them. I'm not from their community. You know, I'm a white guy. And they are colored. And they have their ways. And even like in Burma, for instance, they viewed speaking English, and a lot of monks didn't speak English up to very recently, because they viewed it as animal speech. Animal speech. That the only proper languages were Pali, you know, Sanskrit around the thing, and Burmese. And English was animal speech because they didn't have a good perception of, you know, the English. It was rough. They didn't like it. So this is very important. We need these conservatives. We need the experience of elders. We need to uphold tradition. And again, this is something like, again, this prior one of justice. We need precedence. You know, we don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. We don't reinvent the wheel with every new generation and so forth. That's, you know. Okay, so here's where the Buddha is quite radical. If you think about it, have you heard, Ananda, whether the Vajrayans do not abduct women and girls from their families and force them to live with them? I have heard, Bhante, that they don't. Ananda, as long as the Vajrayans do not abduct women and girls from their families and force them to live with them, only growth is to be expected from them, not decline. So it's quite significant that the Buddha is giving special emphasis here to particularly women and girls. I take it meaning women and children or young, you know. We take for granted, you know, again, it's not the 100th anniversary. I could be wrong, but, you know, when did women get the vote? I think Australia was one of the first, right? Was the first, maybe. Fucking proud of that. But, you know, it seems to me that we're still rolling out, you know, you could say rights. So this right to not be abducted if you're a woman or a girl from your own family and forced to live with somebody else. I mean, this sadly goes on to this very day. You know, the war in Yugoslavia. The Central Democratic Republic of the Congo. This is a weapon of war. It's a right. This year's Nobel Prize for the Yazidi girls, Yazidi girls, I don't know how you pronounce the tribe, where they were just abducted en masse. This ain't gone away. And yet here we are in Australia, and even it hasn't gone away here. We still have a stolen generation, and from what I read, it hasn't ended quite. It's still a stain. I know in Ireland, the abduction of women and girls by the Catholic Church has been a tremendous downfall within religion there. Forced to live with others. Yeah, they were orphaned off. Royal Commission, only last year, reporting on this. Oh. This isn't stuff in the past. 2,500-year-old stuff? No, it's human stuff going on. This is something we have to work so hard as a society to cultivate. So I was very inspired. There's a friend of mine, he's in Melbourne, he's Chinese. He was an engineer, he came down from Malaysia, and he couldn't get a job as an engineer, so he joined the police force. If you know anything about Malaysia, Chinese joining the police force doesn't happen in Malaysia anymore anyway. And I was very praiseful of it, because we need Chinese police officers, and we need Sri Lankan police officers, and lots of different, to reflect our community, and so we can have better access. And he told me that for the younger police now, when you go through the academy, he said that there is a real emphasis put on domestic violence. And a lot of studies have shown that children who are exposed to domestic violence, like basically every criminal has been exposed to domestic violence. Everybody in jail has been exposed to domestic violence. So as a big police initiative nowadays, now the cadets coming out now, not the older police, for them it's not the training they received, it's a different culture, and they're trying to change the culture from grassroots up, that they have to respond to domestic violence and treat it very seriously as an intervention, with the fruit being something that we'll only start to see in maybe 20 years' time, when we have less and less criminality because of the violence that those children were being exposed to. This is very profound. We're still working on this as a society. But I'm very grateful to Australia for the safety that it does provide. And I think it's not the worst in the world. And it's certainly worth protecting here. So next is, have you heard, Ananda, whether the Wadjis honour, respect, esteem and venerate their traditional shrines, both those within the city and those outside, and do not neglect the righteous oblations as given and done to them in the past? So traditional Australian shrines, of course we have, I think Uluru is getting closed off, right? Next year? Soon we can't go to Uluru. I feel that there are a lot of, this idea that we can have a shrine, we can have a sacred place, we can have a safe space, like here. You know, it is treated quite seriously. If there's a difference between somebody coming in here and threatening us, for instance, if we were a football club versus if we were a religious club. So this would be more of a hate crime if somebody came in here and threatened us. So it has a different level within Australian society that actually it is valued, and it would be perceived, again, this may be reflecting the ethic of divinity, that there is something valuable in what we're doing. Okay? There's something valuable in what we do. Today, I had the privilege of being part of the Dharma services, this morning and yesterday. And, we were being warned against theft, to be careful of our stuff being stolen. And there's something quite repugnant about that idea that people would come in and take the wallet of somebody who's sitting in meditation. Do you see the disgust in it? This kind of epic of divinity being corrupted, and you know, that people be able to feel safe and secure. Most of the people who are supporting are women and children, and they're sharing their culture with each other, and we respect this sanctity of a place, that people be safe here, and that we respect that as other civilians. Like, you know, I don't go past the other churches and say, oh, they're damn fools or whatever like that. I just go, oh, that's a beautiful building and they've put so much time and effort into it. I've been very happy to, I've done joint marriage services and joint funeral services, you know, with other religious and in their establishments and so forth. And it can be very elevating. You know, I won't say maybe bemused. Can I put it in a way? I feel amused slightly when I go to Bunnings and I see a Buddha Rupa head or something in the Bunnings garden section for people's, yeah, that they want a sacred space in their back garden somewhere. I was quite amused today when somebody offered, they wanted holy water, you know, blessing holy water, that they were going to add it to their kids' pool as an indirect way of blessing their kids. You know, but this idea of a sacred space and us not, you know, defiling or doing damage or harm, or, you know, that we respect the sacred grounds and sacred spaces of others is very, very important. You know, it's very important, and we do this here. You know, we do this here. Ananda, as long as the Bhajis honor, respect, and venerate their traditional shrines, both those within the city and those outside, and do not neglect the righteous oblations as given and done to them in the past, only growth is to be expected for them, not decline. So this is something we see here in Australia. Again, it was quite noticeable that ISIS particularly attacked, you know, what's it called, Palmitra, or one of these, you know, these great old UNESCO sites, and destroyed them and destroyed the images of what they call the images of God, because that was heresy, and, you know, it's a horrific kind of, you know, or the great Buddha images in Afghanistan being mortared for several months and so on. You know, those it hurt a lot of people worldwide. You know, that it was a sort of a denigration of civilization. It was a denigration of an act of ignorance. Great ignorance. Have you heard, Ananda, whether the Vajis provide righteous protection, shelter, and guard for arahants with the intention, how can those arahants who have not yet come here come to our realm? And how can those arahants who have already come dwell at ease here? So, again, it's not easy to know who an arahant is. But I like this word, how can those arahants who have not yet come to our realm? That people who are striving along this path of arahantship are welcome. You know, we have religious workers visas that are issued to us. And, you know, it's quite interesting to me, having grown up in Ireland, for instance, where the Catholic Church was very, very strong. And when I immigrated in 1996, you know, 80% of the population regularly attended church service. And in 2014, 80% of the population did not attend church service. It's a complete inversion within the society. And it was very distinctive, as a wearer of the Arahant's flag, as a bearer of the Arahant's flag, I would be the last seat that anybody would sit next to on the bus. Do you know how many bus trips I took in a year of living in Ireland? I won't tell you, count that out, but it was a lot. I would take a bus down to my meditation group, two buses down, two buses back. Everywhere I went, there was buses involved. And everywhere I went, you can be sure the bus was jam-packed before anybody would sit next to me, and it wasn't out of respect. If I'm in Melbourne, people will make a space on the bus or on the tram for me, or they'll invite me. They'll say, would you like to sit? And we like to think of Australia as quite an atheistic kind of society, but there's a space being made for those not yet here, but maybe on the way, towards our ownership. And as, you know, agnostic and a-religious and a secular society as Australia is, it is a welcoming place. I don't feel hostility. Everywhere I went in Ireland, especially, you know, around Dublin where I was staying at the time, every day, every time I went out, Hare Krishna, Hare, hey Hare. And I grew up in Ireland and I know there's a difference between it being funny and not funny. And I'm telling you, it was never funny, ever, ever funny. It was always a denigrating remark. You know, it was another way of saying loser or, you know, crazy guy. I have never, ever in my life here in Australia had anybody ever say to me, Harry. So I have heard, Bante, that they do so. Ananda, as long as the Wajis provide righteous protection, shelter and guard for arahants with the intention, how can those arahants who have not yet come here to our realm? And how can those arahants who have already come dwell at ease here? Only growth is to be expected, not decline. So I value my life as a monk. I value what I do as a monk. There's a lot of things that I could do as a monk, or as a person, I could do many things. I had a reasonably successful life before I ordained. I presume, although I'm getting older, that I could return to a successful life. But I really follow this, one, because of enlightenment. I would like to become enlightened. I would like to be an arahant. You know? This is a very admirable intention. And to have the opportunity to practice, to become an arahant, and to be supported by a society that supports this. There's a reason for 2,500 years, not a reason. There are reasons for 2,500 years the Buddhist asana has not extended outside of the traditional Buddhist areas. And one of the very few places in the world outside of the traditional areas is here in Australia. Here in Perth, here in Melbourne, Sydney, Brisbane. That's extraordinary. 2,500 years. Buddhism does not arise. It is not supported. It is not, you know, it's not, it's a very fragile thing. Because it depends on such amazing development within civilization. Requires tremendous pillars of democracy and justice and all kinds of things to be very, very firm and strong within a society for the arahants to be able to arise. So this is something very, very profound. And I really hope that you can appreciate your support of this arahant patship here in Perth and your own role in this as members of society. And this is profound work. So I hope it helps you to fulfill your own maybe ambitions or intentions to be enlightened sometime. So maybe that's where we could draw a halt to it. If you have any questions, we have about 15 minutes. I hope today's, it hasn't been a rigorous Pali session, but I hope you can forgive me. And I hope it hasn't, I have no intention of being preachy or something like that. I'm just trying to give my own color on some of these texts and words. It's a rather short sutta, but I think also always impressive. I'll take questions from the floor, but also from the net, if you like. Anybody? Okay, think of a question. So we have from Phoenix, USA. Is it possible that we merely have the perception of free will rather than actually having it? If so, that case, would it undermine appeals to any moral authority? Well, we have intention. There's two types of intention that are very important. One is the word we use is chanda. So chanda is like the aspiration, the intention to be, like it mentions here, an arahant. We aspire to be an arahant, and we take that as a goal or a direction. And then we have the other word of intention, meaning the intention involved in every action. So if I raise my hand, there's an intention to raise the hand, there's an intention to lower the hand, there's an intention of breathing. Everything that's going on in our body, there's an intention for it to happen at some level. You know, obviously it becomes highly automated. And for instance, when one becomes debilitated, you really start to appreciate how intentional a lot of things are when you have to rehabilitate yourself. I had knee surgery last year, and I had to kind of, you know, really undergo quite a bit of rehabilitation and physio and so forth. So the intention in the act of moving and bending and stepping and all this kind of thing was very, very dominant to me, or very clear to me at that time. And you know, again, I think it's very important, as I mentioned at the very start, of how conditioned any moral decision is. There's a lot of conditioning in it. Like we can take for granted a lot of the wonderful things that are happening here in Australia, like we've mentioned, from assemblies all the way through to the freedom to develop and cultivate the path of arahantship. So there is a free will, I think. There is free will, but it is such a small thing. You know, we are so deeply conditioned by our nature, our nurture, our environment, our moment-to-moment situation that we're in. And I really like in the Samyutta Nikaya, in the chapter, there's a whole section in there on nutriment. But I remember that the Buddha describes in one of the suttas, he describes it as kamma citta utuahara. So kamma is the past actions that have brought us to where we are. Chitta is the mind, and in this case it's particularly pointing towards intention as very important. And then utu is the environment, you know, the weather, the place, the location, the utu. And then the ahara is the nutriment or the food. And for instance, you know, I have been sick many, many times in Asia because the nutriment didn't agree with my health. Or the utu, the environment, didn't agree with my health and the diseases and so forth. And I had the karma of being, I'm not born to an Asian mother, so I didn't have all the T cells and the immunosystem to deal with the diseases that, you know, the locals didn't even know existed. And, you know, but I had an intention to stay there and live there, and I've lived a very long, you know, reasonable number of years, 13 years in Asia. So that was my intention, and I had some free will in it. But I would also like to point out that it is balanced against all these other constraining factors. So as I mentioned earlier on, you, to put it in an American tense, you're born a Democrat and you die a Republican. You know, we may think at times that we have the freedom to do whatever we want and we have total free will, but that doesn't exist either. So it's a middle way. It's a middle way of balancing what is possible with what we would, you know, we wish for, you know. So there isn't an absolute free will of where, for instance, I can change into being an Asian, which would suit me to live in it when I live in Asia. You know, I can't just transmorph myself like some cartoon figure or character or imaginary being. I have constraints. But I do think we can be aware of our conditioning, and I've mentioned the moral bubbles that we can live in, and I've mentioned these ethical factors that are, you know, part of the moral equation, and sometimes we need to be aware of our conditioning. And I make a lot of effort to lean into the opposite. Like Ajahn Chah had this teaching, if you're leaning a little bit too, shall we say, left, try leaning a little bit right. And morally, that also follows. You know, if you've been a sort of flag-burning, left-wing liberal, try a little bit more right-leaning, just as an experiment in how our moral bubble exists and how we can be quite uncomfortable in a different moral space. You understand? And that's been a very interesting an activity that I consciously make an effort to do myself. So when I don't put too much time and effort into some of the newspapers, but there's a website I like called All Sides, and it tries to present the news as left, center, and right. So it'll have an anti-Trump, neutral Trump, and pro-Trump perspective, if you understand. And I find that really interesting to read the three different perspectives of the same so-called news item. And it tells me a lot about my own moral emotions and feelings. Like I'm say disgusted by certain behavior, or I find, oh, that's very palatable. And then I'll see it twisted the other way around in the other newspaper. And it's like, wow, okay, I'm so conditioned. I'm in such a bubble of my own thinking and views. And I really like that. I really like shaking it up and kind of going, ah, there you go. That's how conditioned this mind is. And I don't have free will as long as I'm highly conditioned. And I have to sometimes embrace and accept my conditioning. I can't just consciously change my Irish accent because I'm now living here in Australia. That's it. I don't have a free will around my Irish accent. I'm sorry. So, do we have any questions? Yeah, Jeff.
Thanks, Ajahn. Could you tell us the number of this sutta so we can look it up later? Thanks.
Oh, this one. It's the chapter of sevens, because we had seven things.
Seven.
And it's section 22, and it's the second sutta in the 22nd. And all these suttas are basically repeated in the first section of the Parinibbana Sutta, which is the Digha Nikaya number 16.
Right. Thanks.
You're welcome. And if you're looking for the YouTube, it's the Mahaparinibbana Sutta Digha Nikaya 16 is where Ajahn Brahmali gives the more scholarly Pali story around this one as well. I hope my class today is complementary to it. I stand on the shoulders of giants, but I don't see very far. I'm a freeloader. You know, it's this thing about the elders. Remember, I was telling you about the elders. They're very useful. Okay, from Deering, USA. How can we protect ourselves from loved ones who are verbally and or physically abusive? So this is from a woman. So as we mentioned here in number five, you know, try to find yourself support, you know, so it's not okay as a woman or a child to be forced to live with people or live in dangerous situations. And if you it's not easy, you know, this is not an easy situation. You know, I would say boundaries are very, very important. And in Buddhism, we always talk about physical, verbal, and mind, actions in body, speech, and mind. And these also reflect boundaries, boundaries in body, boundaries in speech, and boundaries in mind. And it's tremendously difficult. This is a tremendously difficult problem as long as humanity exists. this is going to be a problem and for us to deal with. But it's not a problem without a solution, so you're not inventing a wheel. So please find an organization or a group or a community near you that can give you direct help with physical and verbal or even mental abuse or spiritual abuse, you know. I know myself that in my own case, that is the advantage of elders, again coming back to the elders. I'm no genius. I view myself as a bit of a dummy, actually. So I really like elders, and I've reached out on occasions to different groups of elders. You know, so if the elders near you are not necessarily monks, maybe you can also find certainly through social workers, they can be helpful in directing you towards elders or groups that can help with physical and verbal abuse. Sometimes that can involve going outside of your family circle to get help. And also, for instance, like from in my own case, I had to look into a lot of why, you know, for instance, there's why I was exposing myself to physical and verbal abuse from people. And I found, for instance, Codependence Anonymous was a very helpful group. So it can take a lot of work to find the ways and the means to protect ourselves verbally and from verbal, physical, sexual, any kind of abuse. But I would say that because you're even asking the question, that this is very important, and I think you should honor this inquiry and make the effort. But it does go back to the previous question, is you do have some free will, and to please exercise that, and then that will be a loving and caring thing for you to do for yourself. So it's 4:30. I hope, if you don't mind, we can draw a close. Is there any final question? Well, then maybe we can just call it close, and if you don't mind, we'll just bow to the Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha.